Hope you're doing great this week. Nick Deolius here with episode 21 of the Far Middle Podcast. Now, if we're assigning sports figures from the past to our episode numbers, when it comes to the number 21, there's only one that we can choose in the sports world. That, of course, is the great Roberto Clemente. If you live in Pittsburgh and you haven't visited the Clemente Museum, or if you're going to be visiting the Steel City soon, you have to check that museum out, the Clemente Museum in Lawrenceville, our Lawrenceville neighborhood in the city. Dwayne Reeder is the director of the Clemente Museum. It is an awesome experience. You get a chance really to learn about the man and see one-of-a-kind pieces tied to his life and his career. It's just chock full of artifacts and memorabilia that's just really awesome. And Dwayne would be a great guest, I think, on a future Far Middle podcast to share a story of how that place came into being. It's a pretty amazing story how he built it into what it is. And I think it's a story that the constant listeners out there would certainly enjoy. So I'm going to sort of pen Dwayne Reeder in for a future episode to share a story with us. Now, speaking of the world of sports and entertainment, I also just saw the other day that Bob Dylan is coming to town in November, late November. I'm going to try to attend that. I've seen him in concert about four or five times, and every time I've seen him, it's something completely different. I mean, sometimes his voice is there and he sounds great. Sometimes in concert, his voice has abandoned him. I've been there when that's occurred, not as much fun. Sometimes the playlist is consisting of his more popular songs, and sometimes he's got playlists that are really obscure, but they actually at times turn out really good. So when he's on, it is certainly a special experience. Let's hope he's on when he's here in late November in Pittsburgh versus the alternative. Dylan, speaking of him, gave an interview back in the 2000s, maybe 2005, 2007, somewhere around there, to the great Ed Bradley, if you guys are familiar with Ed Bradley from 60 Minutes fame. And in that interview, he was asked by Bradley about why he had a mistrust of and a rocky relationship with the media through the years of his career. I thought Dylan's answer to that question was really interesting because his answer was one where he said, quote, "The press, the media, they're not the judge. God's the judge. The only person you have to think about lying to twice is either yourself or God. The press isn't either of them. I just figured they're irrelevant," end quote. And I heard that from that Dylan interview that I just thought of when I saw he was coming to Pittsburgh. And I'm thinking about his answer to that question about media sitting here in late 2021. I think he was right, and I think it was off on two key pieces of his view or his answer. Where he was right is about the media wanting to be the judge. Certainly that's the case, and not being the judge. That's absolutely the case. But I think he underestimated the media's relevance. Today, the media is quite relevant, not only in regard to promoting whatever view or storyline they desire, but also perhaps being even more powerful in its ability to suppress facts and developments that matter greatly today. So I think he was very accurate and astute with the media wanting to be the judge and not being the judge. But I disagree with him, at least sitting here in late 2021, where I do think the media, unfortunately, is more relevant than we might like. So going from the 21st Clemente episode of the Far Middle podcast, jumping over to Dylan's views on the media, I want to now tie those into three more connections today on our podcast that we'll invest the time into. And these are three issues that you probably have never read about or heard about, but are really important, really impactful, and they are cold, hard facts. The three things that I'd like to discuss today, first, let's talk about yet another professional casualty of the rigid ideology and the police state mentality that you see across academia in the United States, higher education system, college, universities, et cetera. Let's then jump to how China and the Chinese Communist Party are openly muscling elite organizations. And the example we'll talk about today is the World Bank, into transforming what was data-driven objective analyses to make assessments and produce results or views, and then transforming them into works of convenient fiction. But it's convenient fiction that serves the Chinese Communist Party aims or objectives. And then we'll jump to our third connection, the final one, and that's how government policy, monetary policy, environmental religion, and radical environmental policy, how they're all coming together in a confluence to make everything out there more expensive and less available for everybody. So it's really starting to wreak havoc from inflation and the cost of goods to just simple supply chains and being able to get your hands on what once were regular and readily available goods, now increasingly becoming more rare on an exception basis. So hope that sounds like a good plan. And with that, let's get to it. And as I said, let's start with the growing count of professional careers that have been ruined in the unforgiving and rigid ideological culture of higher education across this country. We spoke on this topic extensively in the past on Far Middle Podcasts, and we talk about it also extensively at nickdeolius.com, my website. I dedicate a couple of chapters on this topic in my upcoming book, which, by the way, now has a new name. That's a hint for you guys to check out. We'll maybe visit that at the end of this podcast. But recently, there was yet another victim of the thought police in academia, one of their own this time, and it was a professor of philosophy at Portland State University out on the West Coast by the name of Peter Boghossian. Now, Boghossian has been a bit of a hero to me for some time. For a philosophy professor, he displays quite a bit of guts and courage in challenging the don't teach, instead preach mindset of academia today. I've been following him for some time. And of course, what are they preaching these days on campuses? Well, of course, it is the ideology and the religion of the left. At the very end of September, he sent his resignation letter to the Portland State Provost, and Boghossian had enough of academia's harsh culture, and he did not mince words in his resignation letter. It's a quick read. It's a very interesting read. You can find it online. The way you spell his name, I believe, is Boghossian. So if you type in Boghossian, resignation letter, Portland State, something like that in your search queue, it will come up with a letter, and you should give it a read. I think you would enjoy it. Now, in the letter, he was lamenting how the university methodically made intellectual exploration impossible because the culture shifted from one of free inquiry, that's what we thought the culture was within academia, but now it's a culture of rigid religion where the outputs, as he put it, are grievance and division. I thought he summed that up quite well. Students aren't being taught to think, but they're instead being trained to mimic moral ideologues. And students attend classes on a regular basis in fear, and they're not going to speak their mind or openly share their thoughts. When the professor challenged or questioned the ideology and the programming of the university, he faced retaliation, including a Title IX investigation that doesn't provide for due process of the accused, including Professor Boghossian in this instance. He quickly concluded the treatment that he was subjected to was not isolated across events, but he saw that it was part of a coordinated institution-wide culture. This was something that was not by happenstance, but part of a much wider coordinated effort. Boghossian also exposed the ridiculous process of peer review publishing in academia and how the most absurd articles find their way into being published in very reputable journals. So he's been sort of famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, for this type of a tactic. Back in 2017, he published an article that underwent extensive peer review in the journal titled Cogent Social Sciences. And in the paper, he was arguing that the male sexual organ was the product of the human mind and it was responsible for causing climate change. That silly hoax paper made it all the way through peer review to publication in that journal. It's amazing how far it got to the point where it was in Cogent Social Sciences. He followed that gem up with another paper, I think a year later in 2018, that argued that dogs were having or experiencing sexual advances that were unwanted from other dogs in dog parks, and that we should leash men the way that we leash dogs because of it. That scholarly work made it through peer review to publication as well, just like his prior paper from 17. And instead of being celebrated for exposing this growing sham of academia and peer review journals and that whole sort of process as it's currently wired and it currently operates, Boghossian instead was punished by Portland State when the school filed charges against him for research misconduct. So not only wasn't he celebrated, he was basically punished. And he's faced assault of his lectures, his reputation, and his body within the not-so-friendly confines of Portland State and wider academia. There's instances of professors disrupting his lectures. There are people that pulled fire alarms during his lectures. Speaker wires were pulled out when he spoke during class or at events on campus. Flyers were sent around campus showing his image with a Pinocchio nose. His name appeared next to swastikas on campus graffiti. and he was spit on and verbally threatened with violence while all this was going on. This is the world of academia today, as ugly as it is. So Boghossian, he teaches his students about the importance of living by their principles. That's one of his subjects or areas of focus for his lectures within his philosophy curriculum. And kudos to the man that had the courage to practice what he taught. They are few and far between in academia these days. Boghossian should be celebrated and defended. I guess moral courage is not dead yet everywhere, which is a good thing to see. Let's jump from the trials and tribulations of Professor Boghossian to our next dot, which is how China and the Chinese Communist Party, they are really adept, very willing to use leverage to force some of the most elite institutions in the world, including academia, to change their findings and views from what were originally and supposed to be fact-based, data-based, science-based, to ones that are increasingly fiction-based. And like the plight of our intrepid professor, you're not going to hear or read much about this type of malfeasance in the media because it inconveniently conflicts with the media's desired rhetoric and storylines, going back to Bob Dylan's observations. Now, we could pick countless elite institutions that succumb to this type of pressure from China. We could look at the IMF. We could look at the UN. I mentioned elite academia. But today, let's focus on one in particular, which is the World Bank. I don't know if you're familiar with the World Bank or not, but it's an institution that looks to address issues in developing countries, poverty issues, health issues, etc. And just to give you a feel for the flavor, the type of things it looks to tackle, one of its larger favorite initiatives is a project titled People, Peace, Prosperity, just to give you a feel for what the World Bank looks to and works on. The organization prides itself on its research and its policy initiatives. That's a core piece of what it does. It, of course, thinks that it does those things quite well, and it considers itself the go-to institution for figuring out the root causes of issues that are facing poor nations, and then what the solutions are, of course, and what the wealthier nations need to do to assist and to bring those solutions to the table sooner rather than later. The World Bank is global. It is stacked with a massive bureaucracy of techno-elites, and it's a very well-funded outfit with commitments totaling in the tens of billions of dollars at any given point in time. So this is not a small organization. Now, one of the most ballyhooed reports that the World Bank issues is the ranking of countries when it comes to the business environment. You might have seen these reports before or media reporting on it. It's what the World Bank calls the doing business rankings. And the report is the culmination, or supposed to be the culmination, of a data-intensive objective analysis that scores each nation across a series of metrics and then comes up with a blended score and ranking from which country is the top one for the best environment for doing business all the way down to the worst. Now, the World Bank, like a lot of these global bureaucratic organizations, it relies on its funding from member countries. And China just so happens to be the third largest shareholder of the World Bank, behind the United States, and I think Japan is number two. A few years ago, the leader of the World Bank was asking nations, particularly China, for $13 billion more in funding. The World Bank leader wanted to grow its budget, and it went to its primary shareholder nations to ask for the additional funds. Because, you know, when you're saving the world, that's expensive work, and all those bureaucrats, they need to be fed. So it's not cheap. In China, at the time when the request for additional budgeting from the World Bank came, China was happy to oblige the World Bank because the Chinese Communist Party is always looking for ways to increase its stature on the global stage, and the World Bank provided an ideal platform for it to do so. But it turns out China had a little ask for the World Bank in exchange for its increased funding. It didn't like its ranking of 85th in the Doing Business 2018 report from the World Bank, and it wanted a better ranking. So it pressured the head of the World Bank to adjust the ratings, and the CEO willingly obliged. She pressured World Bank economists to fudge the numbers and to elevate China's rankings, and the economists were able to do so. They obliged the CEO due to fear, I would assume, of retaliation. Well, it turns out that the 2018 Doing Business report ranked China 78th in the world instead of the lower ranking and rating. The CEO even went so far to thank the pressured staff for, I think the term she used was doing their bit for multilateralism, end quote, whatever that means, after they manufactured the falsehood and pushed aside the process and the real data. By the way, the then CEO of the World Bank is now the managing director of the IMF. So sometimes failure and scandal, they often get you promoted up when you're dealing with unaccountable bureaucracies like the World Bank and the IMF. Like Dylan said, the media wants to be the judge, and this story doesn't fit the desired judgment and the desired ruling. That's why you're not going to hear near enough about it out there. Now let's jump from the dot we just talked about, China and some of its puppets that are out there, these elite organizations and global organizations like the World Bank. Let's jump into and connect it to our third and final dot, which is how these flawed elite global institutions, they profess to know the answer to the world's problems, but they're actually making things worse. In fact, they're making things much worse for everyone and everybody. Consider the array of massive entities that are at work here. You've got central banks, including our Fed, that are pumping huge amounts of free money into every economy system like a drug that everyone becomes addicted to and that creates asset bubbles and inflation. You've got governments across the globe that are outspending to colossal levels, including our own government, that overstimulates and stokes inflation, creates debt bombs. You've got regulators and regulations that shutters economies haphazardly in the name of public health or in the name of saving the planet. But yet they're destroying reliable infrastructure like our power grids, and they're replacing them with costly and very unreliable alternatives. And then you've also got this implementation of entitlements that are steadily eroding the work ethic of culture and the work ethic of nations. We talked about that on a prior episode of The Far Middle. All of these things are creating massive disruptions to the supply chain and to the economic engines of societies. Now, this expert class and this elite class, it does all this lecturing and it makes all the decisions for us, but yet they're unaccountable with little to no experience in the real world and the true economy. You combine all these forces at work at one time together, and it leads to where we are today. And where are we today? Well, look at things like supply chain and supply chain disruptions. You can't buy toilet paper and paper towels today at Costco or Walmart. What do you think is going to happen if this continues when you want to buy a car tomorrow or some other advanced form of a consumer product? Ports all over the world are log jammed, and every link in that supply chain, doesn't matter if it's the dock workers, to the rail lines, to the trucking companies, the warehouses, the retailers, none of them can get enough workers off the couches to show up to relieve the bottlenecks. So things are just getting worse and building upon themselves. There are gas lines in the United Kingdom for gasoline for cars. And I fear that those gas lines are coming to the United States sooner than you think. All of that is self-inflicted by the expert class in some of these radical views or policies that they're trying to implement upon all of us. The lights, as you know, they went out in California. They continue to go out in California, depending on what the weather is and if the wind's blowing. And it also happened in Texas over this past winter. And I fear it will be likely to do so elsewhere if this country experiences a cold winter. Now, why do I have that concern? Why am I afraid of that? Because again, radical environmentalism and their enablers in government, they don't allow things like natural gas pipelines to be built to serve demand. They don't allow things like natural gas wells to be drilled, and they don't allow homes to be hooked up to reliable and cheap sources of natural gas supply. Worse yet, while they're barring those things, they're demanding that we rely on wind and solar, which can't be counted on, has been proven time and time again, specifically numerous times in California, and as I said, also Texas. Now remember, when it's winter, or the dead of winter in the Northeast United States, and the lights go out, it goes from an inconvenience to a life and death situation. People will die, and obviously we don't want to see that happen. You can go from looking at and assessing supply chains into something as simple as inflation itself. The Federal Reserve keeps calling it transitory inflation, and it keeps inching the target up by moving the goalposts from what was 1.8% for a target to 2%, to now I think it's 2.3%. And transitory, when the Fed talks about it, now means years, not months, right? And the business press keeps excluding things like rent and gas and power and food and every other imaginable necessity to make the inflation rate look lower than it really is. But then there is the reality that every person who shops knows is out there. So what's the reality? Well, if you're paid hourly, your hourly wage, it might have increased, and it's also been completely consumed and overtaken by higher prices for everything. So any wage gains that you enjoyed recently in your hourly rate, has been completely consumed by higher prices for everything else. A dollar more in that you got on wages and $2 out on more expensive everything. You lose, the worker loses. The price of a dozen eggs, it's almost doubled. I just saw this the other day. It's almost doubled from $2 to almost $4 a dozen, and everything in the grocery store now costs more. I predict by the time we get to Thanksgiving and Christmas, the holiday season, I think food inflation is going to be raging by then. It's going to be much worse than it is today. We're going to wish for prices that we're experiencing today, even though there's significant increases over what we've seen a year or two ago. Rents, those that rent apartments and rent homes, they're raging. Housing asset bubbles inflate and environmental regulations stifle supply of new housing. So you got this asset bubble thing going on because of free money, creating sort of a speculative environment for housing. That's increasing rents. You've got environmental regulations that don't allow new affordable housing units to be built to the extent that they normally would be built to meet the demand. That's limiting supply, raising rents. All of that, of course, hurting the renter. Gasoline and power prices, so electricity and gasoline prices, they are going up. Why are they going up? They're going up because of the religion of the climate, which demands reduced investments in reliable and cheap energy, like natural gas, and places us instead on a portfolio of expensive energy, whether it's wind and solar, that we all end up paying for via subsidy that flows from the utility to the ratepayer one way or another. So you always hear things like these incentives and how solar and wind are increasingly competitive or affordable. That's all nonsense, because that's all premised on subsidy. And in the end, if the multi-billion dollar corporation, the utility, is being subsidized to spend money on unreliable and costly forms of power or electricity in the grid, in the end, one way or another, the consumer, the business owner, the doer is going to pay for that one way or another in the end. In Germany and the UK, they historically, before us, caved to environmental radicals and the religion of climate. And what do they have now? Now they see their power prices are posting the highest increases seen in years, or in some instances, depending on what you're looking at, on record. And that's just, again, a natural consequence of the policies that they pursued and who they trusted with setting policy when it came to the expert class and the elite class. Money is free. Asset bubbles are inflated. People are incentivized to not work. Bureaucrats are deciding to create winners and losers based on their subjective views within industries instead of letting competition decide that. And budgets are blown out incessantly with government debt skyrocketing. And of course, this regulatory state, it brings activity one way or another to a grinding halt. All of this is going to end badly for us. And I think we're just starting to figure that out. We're just starting to come to that realization. But there are beneficiaries of this insanity of the expert class. Two beneficiaries in particular, Russia and China. The first with oil and natural gas, and the second with wind and solar. So let's talk about Russia first. Our friends in Europe are willingly shuttering their natural gas fields in the name of saving the planet. Well, now instead of saving the planet, they need Putin to save them, because they're out of natural gas and power, and they need to keep the lights on and their economies functioning. So they shuttered their own natural gas fields. They thought that renewables were going to fill that gap in a very safe, reliable, cost-effective way. They've been wrong. Now they're desperate. They didn't end up saving the planet, and instead now they need Putin to save them and provide their megawatt hours, kilowatt hours, and gasoline. So Russia's Putin, what did he do when he figured all this out and saw this, besides being quite happy about it? He slowed deliveries of natural gas to Europe recently during this crisis that they're going through. And why did he do that? He wanted to make a point and to ensure that that Nord 2 pipeline to Germany got finished. I'm sure he'll do the same to Boston this winter, since Bostonians and in Beantown, they can't get Pennsylvania natural gas in winter due to government policies that stop pipelines from being built. But instead, they get some of their natural gas and their heating supply from a 4,000-plus mile supply chain from Siberia and the Arctic, what I call the Putin Express. What about China? Well, China wins a different way. They get to mine and process all those minerals and compounds to make those expensive, carbon-intensive, and unreliable solar panels and wind farms. In the U.S., we are taking a strategic asset of energy independence as the leaders of oil and natural gas production that we acquired, that we earned through innovation and ingenuity. And what are we doing? We're turning it over to a reliance on China for the stuff that's needed for wind and solar type of generation. Build back better it might be more about building up China instead. That's just about a wrap for episode 21 of the Far Middle Podcast. We started with Roberto Clemente, episode 21. We jumped over to Bob Dylan and his views on the media. And then we talked about three connected stories that you don't hear enough about in the media: academia's growing professional body count and the plight of Professor Boghossian, the World Bank showing how yet another expert elite institution fails at the most fundamental of ethical mores when China comes knocking, and how all these types of elite entities are converging to strangle supply chains, to grow inflation, and to manufacture all kinds of crises: crises of economies, of finance, crises in quality of life, and crises when it comes to individual rights. Alexandre Dumas, he wrote The Three Musketeers, of course, and The Count of Monte Cristo, two excellent books. He once wrote, quote, "I'd rather have 10 soldiers to guard than a single scholar," end quote. How true when it comes to today's culture in academia, when it comes to elite bureaucrats at global behemoths like the World Bank, and when it comes to regulators in government and the administrative state. Are all these experts and elites what they consider themselves to be, or are they something else different altogether? I think to give you my view of it, I'm going to use the words of the great Bob Dylan, since he seems to be a subject of this episode of the podcast. I'm going to use a quote from a song on the great album Blood on the Tracks: "Idiot wind, blowing every time you move your mouth. You tell them, Bob, you tell them." Also mentioned earlier that I've got the new name for the book that will be published here in January of 2022. The title of the book has been changed. It's gone from what was originally The Leech to our new title, which is Precipice. And I'm very excited and I'm very troubled about this name change at the same time. And the reason that I'm excited is that it truly does reflect the evolution that we've seen here the past couple of years in this country. When I first started writing the book and had it titled The Leech, it was much more of a concept that I was describing and trying to help identify and illustrate across major segments of our economy and our society. It was much more conceptual. Through the 2 or 3 years that it took to write and get to publication date, the conceptual, unfortunately, has turned into the reality. Everybody sees it, I think, for what it is and what is occurring today. And it feels much more to be a situation today where we're on literally a precipice as a nation and as a society. So again, excited about the name change because it's more timely of a topic than ever before. That's exciting when you're an author where you think you've got something that's capturing the current situation, the current environment that's out there. But it's quite a troubling one for me because unless we work together to avoid the next step while we're on the precipice, which could be a fatal one, we stand a chance of taking that next step and plunging into a void. That would be a horrible thing for what is the greatest nation in the history of mankind. So let's work together to ensure that we don't. But Precipice, as I said, will be published here in January of 2022. And if you miss me between now and the next episode of the Far Middle Podcast, episode 22, it will be, don't worry, you can check me out on Twitter at Nick DeOlius, and you can check out the website, nickdeolius.com. Talk soon. Bye for now.